You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
3 years after a Vancouver police officer shot and killed a man who was staying at a shelter for homeless people in downtown Vancouver, a coroner's jury spent 3 days examining the incident. Michael Van Hubbert had struggled with mental illness for many years. His death was preceded by the police approaching him to investigate a crime he did not commit. After the police officer shot him, he was not given immediate medical attention, and he died before he was transported to hospital. The coroner's inquest into Michael Van Hubbert's death concluded in April and made recommendations aimed at preventing similar tragedies from occurring in the future. Douglas King, a lawyer at Pivot Legal, represented Michael's family at the inquest, and he joins me now. Hello, Doug.
Hello.
Who was Michael Van Hubbert?
Well, Michael was an American living in Canada. He had been in Vancouver for just over a year when the incident happened. He originally grew up in Houston, Texas, and spent a lot of his youth working as a pipe fitter in the oil industry. He had a family, and he had two daughters. Both daughters ended up moving to Illinois, and when he was in his, I guess, early 40s or so, I think he joined them. So he lived in Illinois for quite a few years. It was in his 20s, I think, that Michael started experiencing symptoms of mental illness, and he was diagnosed with schizophrenia soon after that. Although that definitely, from his family's account, was not actually the main part of his life. It was one part of his life, and it had a profound influence on his life, but certainly wasn't the defining part of his life. So as he grew a bit older, he kind of was caught in a bit of, I guess, of a bureaucratic conundrum in the States, where if he was working, he wasn't going to be getting benefits which would have allowed him to pay for his medication to treat his schizophrenia. But he didn't want to be just on disability because he wanted to be working. And so he came up to Canada with the hope that he could do both work and have medical treatment for his illness.
Now, the incident that led to the Vancouver police confronting Michael Van Hubbert in 2009 followed a report of theft from a vehicle in the downtown area.
Yeah.
How and why did police treat Michael as a suspect?
Well, one of the interesting parts of the inquiry was the police admitted that when they approached Mr. Van Hubbert, they approached him because he was staying at the Belkin House, which is a shelter in downtown Vancouver. And they received a call related to a theft from a vehicle, which was about 4 or 5 blocks away from Mr. Hubbert's location. And they essentially attended to the shelter because they said it was common practice when they receive calls about crimes in the downtown area, and a description of a possible suspect, they'll go to the homeless shelters looking for that suspect, assuming that that person might be there.
So if in my street a car is broken into, I could expect a call from the police checking out whether I was responsible for that?
Well, you probably wouldn't see it in other neighborhoods. It's the reality of, I guess, a different kind of profiling than what's often talked about when it comes to police profiling. But it's a reality that the police definitely profile homeless individuals on the assumption that the majority of homeless people are engaged in criminal activity. And I, from my experience interacting with homeless people, I think that's actually quite far from the truth. So the initial interaction where the police approached Mr. Hubbert was, you know, in part because he was in the wrong place in the wrong time. He was sitting outside the shelter. He had a couple items or articles of clothing that might have vaguely matched the description they were given, and that was, in the police's eyes, grounds enough to approach him and request a search of his backpack.
So what circumstances then led to his being shot and killed?
Well, one of the biggest factors, I think, was the request to search, and that's has always been, for me, one of the most difficult parts about this case. There wasn't much discussion, you know, from the beginning and at the coroner's inquest either about whether or not the police actually had a legal right to be searching his backpack under those circumstances. And I think what the police didn't understand and still have a hard time understanding is if someone is homeless, it's often that their entire life and all of their possessions that they have are pretty much located in that backpack. So when you're saying that you want to search that backpack, it's almost the equivalent of saying that you want to search somebody's entire house. And And not surprisingly, there's a lot of scenarios and situations where a homeless individual who is requested of that or asked of that is going to be confrontational. They're going to deny that, and they're going to be protective of their belongings. And that's essentially what happened in Mr. Hubbard's case. He was immediately protective of his belongings. He pulled out a small hobby knife to try to get the police officers to back off, and that escalated the system, which led to guns being drawn.
And in the end, one of the police officers shot Michael.
They did, and there was this, you know, kind of very strange. It was a strange interaction from the beginning, and then I think at that specific period in time, it's safe to say that unfortunately Michael was having more problems than he usually did with his illness. And as he interacted with the officers, you know, it's no one's really going to be able to know what was going on in his head, but. He didn't obey the request that they made to put down the knife, and eventually, after a standoff of, you know, about a minute or so, as he kind of stumbled forward, one of the officers took a single shot, and that single shot was enough to kill him.
Now, the jury heard from both police officers at the scene, Officer Wicks, who shot him, and her partner, Officer Tisdall. What evidence was given about their training with dealing with people suffering from mental health issues?
Well, the interesting thing is that they insisted that they had received quite a bit of training, and they actually seemed to be completely unaware that there was more training available to them. When I had questioned them about the type of training they received in crisis intervention training, they believed that they had received that higher-level course and that they had received the most training possible. And they were kind of surprised to hear that there was this different course, which is a 40-hour course taught independently from the police kind of Justice Institute school. And according to the records, neither officer had taken that course. So I think that'll always be a question in the mind of the family is whether or not if the officers had better training when it comes to crisis intervention training, that they would have been able to respond to the scenario differently and in a way that didn't escalate it to the point where it, obviously it ended.
Now, Michael Van Hubbard died at the scene, but I understand he wasn't given the emergency medical attention that might have possibly saved his life. What happened?
Well, this was the first coroner's inquest that I had done, and I was surprised to hear that this is actually an issue that's shown up at many coroner's inquests, and I think it really shows a bit of the stubbornness when it comes to police forces and how they deal with situations like this. The main reason why Mr. Hubbard did not receive immediate care and was not transported to hospital was because after the shot was fired, the police protocol says that immediately the officer is supposed to call it out over the system, and then basically what happens is as many officers as are nearby as possible attend the scene. And their job is to seclude the shooters, so the shooter and the partner were immediately taken back to the station and separated, which is the correct protocol. And the other officers on scene were then meant to try to gather witnesses and try to get statements from as many people as possible about what happened before they left the scene. And the document suggests they did a very thorough job of that. The one thing that they didn't do was they didn't leave space and they didn't create an opportunity for emergency services and the ambulance to actually make it to Mr. Hubbard's body. So when the ambulance arrived on scene, they were physically blocked from being able to get there because a police cruiser had cordoned off the street to try to canvass witnesses, and the officer who had the keys for the car had left, so no one had the ability to move that car. And it was simply a physical object preventing Mr. Hubbard getting the care that he needed.
What were the jury's recommendations?
Well, one of the jury's recommendations was that they need to review that emergency scene protocol, and I think the message being that there's no real excuse for not allowing an ambulance to arrive to a scene after the police have caused an injury to somebody. In fact, you know, I think one of the hardest things for the family to deal with was realizing, I guess, that the police had caused the injury, that they'd shot him, and then they had also prevented him from getting care. And at the same time, the police were saying that they don't train their officers in first aid. The officers themselves, you know, don't have any kind of experience in the realm of paramedics do. And they've been kind of afraid to give them that training for a variety of reasons, and mostly because of costs. And so it really kind of seemed like a scenario where the police wanted to have it both ways, where they didn't want to train their officers to take the responsibility of giving medical care for the people that they shoot. But they also didn't want to create a protocol or compromise their own protocols to allow emergency services personnel to provide that care.
Did the jury make recommendations around the crisis intervention training or the interactions with people with mental illness?
They did, and that was one of the things we were hoping for, and we were really happy to see it. We heard evidence during the inquest from one of the officers who was involved with the training that it's been a goal of the police department for the last few years to try to get every officer who's on patrol to have that higher level of training. And at the time the inquest started, and a few years ago when the shooting occurred, the police were telling us that at that time there was about 25% of the force that had received that training. And I think in part because of Mr. Hubbard's shooting and the inquest, as well as the Paul Boyd inquest and shooting, we've been told now this year that the rate of officers being trained in that course is now up to about 75%. So they're on the right track, and what the recommendation said is basically that they need to keep doing that, and they need to get it till it's 100%. And that's a commitment that I think the people of Vancouver, you know, expect the Vancouver Police Department to honor.
Doug, what was your response to the overall coroner's inquest and to the recommendations that came out of it?
Well, it's an interesting process, and I think it has an important role to play, for sure. One thing that really is difficult, I think, to deal with, you know, representing the family and then also from a personal perspective, is the coroner's inquest is not a good substitute for a real proper inquest into a police shooting, which decides whether or not faults should be apportioned and whether or not there should be charges laid and that sort of thing. And unfortunately, in BC, you know, when Mr. Hubbard was shot, we had a terrible system. We now are in the making of a new system with the Independent Investigations Office, but we still have a long way to go. And when the family is kind of left with just the coroner's inquest to try to, I guess, receive a bit of solace and kind of accountability for what happened, it's not a great venue for that. It's not meant to be a fact-finding expedition or a fault-finding expedition. And you're really limited in the kind of questions you can ask the officers. So, you know, there's some positives that come out of it, for sure, but I still think that the families of incidents like these have really been left wanting for a real proper inquest into what happened to their loved ones.
Do the results of the coroner's inquest, the recommendations that the juries made, give you confidence that an unnecessary death like this could be prevented in the future?
Not necessarily, and I think in part because while the Vancouver Police Department has made commitments when it comes to training, you know, there's a bigger issue with culture that they don't seem to be willing to address, and it really comes down to just the general use of force and the way that they kind of dole out use of force techniques. And my personal feeling is that until there's real consequences for mistakes when it comes to use of force, especially mistakes that involve people's deaths, they're going to be pretty much continuing on the same path. And I think my hope, I guess, is that when we do have the Independent Investigations Office set up, if there's some successful investigations where officers are charged for, you know, the most egregious shootings like the one that we saw with Mr. Boyd's case, then that might have an actual kind of chilling effect and an impact on the officers on the street, and they're going to really think twice before they decide to use their firearm. The one real disadvantage, the coroner's inquest, and the one thing that unfortunately leads me to be a bit skeptical is that there are no actual provisions for enforcing the recommendations. So there would just remain recommendations, and the police forces can decide to follow them if they want to or not. And, you know, there might be political consequences for that. There might be, you know, public opinion consequences. But at the end of the day, there's nothing that we can do to force the Vancouver Police Department to do the things the jury wants them to do.
Well, I really appreciate your joining me this morning, Doug.
Yeah, sure thing.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
I've been speaking with Douglas King. He's a lawyer with Pivot Legal. He represented the family of Michael Van Hubbard at the coroner's inquest into his death.